Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me, Sean Delaney, and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On a previous programme, I spoke to Dr. Rob Evans, who was a keynote speaker at the 2015 Irish Primary Principals Network annual conference. Rob Evans is a psychologist and the executive director of the Human Relations Service in Wellesley, Massachusetts. His interests are in the areas of change and resistance to it in schools and organisations, and on the challenges of leading innovation. In the first part of my interview with Rob, we discussed the difference between problems and dilemmas for primary principals, change in schools, and the rewards of being a school principal, and seven secrets of a savvy school principal. When Rob and I spoke, we also talked about strategic planning for schools, the difference between congenial and collegial relations in schools, and about the extent to which schools can close the achievement gap among students in school. I bring you that part of our conversation in this week's programme. I had a fair idea from reading some of Rob's work that he was not a fan of strategic planning for schools. And when I mentioned that to him in the interview, his reaction was definite.
I certainly am not.
Why not?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not a fan of it as it's typically done. And by typically done, I mean a couple of things. One, repeatedly every 3 to 5 years. Gets to be a kind of a ritual. Most of the plans are not actually strategic. What you do is strategic planning ends up giving you a plan, but not a strategy. And the plans, at least, I don't know about in Ireland, but I can tell you in the U.S., they get longer and longer and longer. Some of them have 45 goals. This is not strategy. This is choking a horse. And being truly strategic includes a couple of things that the normal planning process doesn't. So one of the things it means is being able to concentrate on the couple of key areas that are absolutely essential. So one example in the U.S. is Abraham Lincoln, probably the greatest president. So he came into office wanting to save the Union from Civil War, and he eventually decided to free the slaves. He was opposed to slavery, but he wasn't the first. And that's essentially all he did, and he did it different ways during his very difficult tenure while hundreds of thousands were being slaughtered and stuff, but he never lost sight of the two things. He didn't have 10 goals and whatnot, he had a couple. So there's that. The second thing is this: strategy is not just the result of numbers and charts and graphs and data and all that stuff. It actually includes the leader's capacity to read the soft signs, the human stuff, to have a sense about what's really possible and to know the culture of the place. And culture of any organization, in my view, certainly a school, dictates how it does what it does much more than any plan does. So I'm in favor of being truly strategic, but to me that means a much healthier respect for the non-hard facts that are crucial to life, especially in schools. And it means not producing plans that, you know, require the slaying of entire forests to produce long lists of things that nobody's ever going to get to. If you go to most schools and you say, show me your last plan, how much of that have you been doing the last 3 years? You just said a minute ago about being reactive. By the time the plan is done, the original problems that were being tackled have already started to shift a little. And something that wasn't on the horizon is suddenly there. And so being strategic to me just doesn't mean going through a huge, lengthy planning process. Most principals could tell you tomorrow what couple of things their schools really need.
It comes back to vision.
Yeah. To knowing what you're really about and what you're really after. And so every now and then it is good to do a full-scale plan. So let's say you have a principal for 20 years, very successful. Everybody in the whole community knows and loves, and you know, and the person retires. And a lot of the teachers have started to retire too, and you have a lot of new staff. well, that could be a very good time for a whole fresh look at who we are, where we're going. That kind of strategic planning, it's okay with me. It's the every 3 to 5 years and going through the motions again and having all the stakeholders and endless meetings and everybody sending out reports. And, you know, you know before you start what it's going to be looking for, which is, you know, God on a good day is what they're after somehow.
You're an expert on, among other things, the complexity of adult life in schools. And if we leave aside the principal for the moment, one of the difficulties for teachers can be relating to their colleagues and, you know, inter-staff relations.
Yep.
What advice would you give to schools where that's a difficulty?
So I don't know schools here. And, I have had several examples of some of the folks here at conference being more willing to be blunt than I'm used to in the States. But my experience in most schools has been that the people who choose a life in schools and who stay in the classroom, who don't, are typically people who are at their best when they're with children, thank God, and who prefer to be with children. And they did not choose the career of teaching so they could go to meetings with other adults. And it's not that they can't work together, but it's not a primary reward of the job. The goal is this: I get in my room with my kids, I shut the door. Ideally, there's not much glass in the door, and what there is, I can cover with a poster from my trip to Barcelona. So no one can see what I'm doing with my children here, and we are all together. And so people will often be very friendly, very cordial, very congenial, but not truly collegial. That is, not nearly so good at talking with each other about growth and performance, that is, adult growth and performance, as opposed to bringing food when there's an illness in the family or, you know. So lots of places they have no real capacity to disagree constructively in the service of professional growth. And a real challenge, that's fine as long as we're happy with a school where it's a series of individual classrooms with relatively little linkage among them. If we're more interested, as most places are now, in having a more collaborative culture and more shared understanding of the work of teaching and the goals for children and so on, then you start putting adults in a situation that they're not so adept at, didn't ever sign up for, and that doesn't come naturally to lots of them. It's not that they're mean or unfriendly or that they can't talk. Usually they're very good at getting along as they agree. When they don't agree, they stop talking to each other and they start talking about each other. And it's what happens in village life. You can't be fully candid with everyone in the village. You can't say everything you think to, you know. But lots of schools need lots of help in learning to be able to say things to each other like, gee, I don't think that's right. I think you're wrong about that. I don't think the children are learning as much as we thought they would with this method, and I wonder if we need to revisit that. Or what makes you say that, and how are you so sure that you're right, and things like that. And one thing the business folk are better at is just a greater willingness to say, you know, that's wrong. I disagree. We have to thrash this out. And so I think lots of schools these days are experiencing greater pressure because the way of the field is moving towards a more collaborative undertaking, and it's not that folks can't do it. It's not a primary skill set for lots of them.
And can that be changed?
Yeah, you can learn on it. I spend a lot of days with the whole faculty where we work on it, but you have to learn to make some specific agreements. For example, the schools that actually learn about this are places where I always say they have a shared commitment to appropriate candor in the service of growth. And the agreement is what we're about here is not just the students' learning and growth, but ours. We have to model learning and growing. And we're trying to do that not person by person separately, but all together. And if that's true, then we have to be willing to try to be more candid as we can in the service of our learning and growth. And we have to realize that if you have 20, 25 people who are intelligent, hardworking, conscientious, it's very rare they're going to all agree about everything. And some of the best learning will come from the disagreement. And as long as it's respectful and in a context of learning, it would be tolerable, expectable, normal. You have to have a norm often that says, I won't be the person who listens to colleague A complain bitterly about colleague B 2, 3, 4 times without saying, you have to take that to her. We can't keep meeting like this. You have to, you know. And so faculties can make an agreement. Yes, we're going to try this. We're going to start this. There are other ways to put people in collegial learning groups together and give them some specific training about how to talk about their work more honestly. And I've seen the schools I know where they're good at this are all ones where they have worked on it, not where it sprang up spontaneously.
Can you say a little bit more about the difference between those two words you used, congenial and yes. collegial?
Yes. So there's a well-known former principal in the U.S. who made this distinction and has written several books in school. His name is Roland Barthes. And what he says is, so congenial is like cordial, caring, friendly, supportive. I have a last period class, but I got a call from my own child's school that she's sick and I have to go get her, and you have a free period and you volunteer to cover my class. I'm having trouble with a student this year and you had last year and you had success, and I ask you, what did you do that worked? You don't hesitate to tell me. This is the bedrock of community in a school. A school without this would be an impossible place. But you can be the most congenial group in the entire world and never once talk about teaching and learning. And in fact, what Roland Barthes always said was, if you go into the teacher's room, the faculty room, the topic least discussed is teaching and learning. And what collegiality is about, he said, is performance and growth. So it's things like, how do we know that we're accomplishing what we say we're accomplishing? Or, given what we started with, what progress has been made? Because most of the schools in the world that do the best, in quotes, are serving the most teachable children, generally from wealthier homes and, you know, lots more advantages. But collegiality is about the how do we get better at doing what we're doing on behalf of the students, but also sort of on our own behalf. So it's not an opposite from congenial. You don't have to give up congenial. You wouldn't want to. But if you're only congenial, you can be a very nice place, but there isn't going to be any growth and development happening there. And in the long run, what's likely to occur is that the teaching itself will stagnate because there isn't really any sort of oomph behind the need for growth and stuff like that.
You mentioned there that the schools who do well are schools who are teaching yeah. the children who are yeah. likely to do well anyway. How well can schools compensate for disadvantage that students bring with them from home?
Well, that's a big question. So my view about that, I subscribe to the view that actually the impact that school is what sociologists would call a weak treatment. If you would like to know how well a child is going to do on a test, a college entrance test or a test of literacy or something, you actually, in most countries, don't need to know which school the child attends. You need to know where the child lives, which is a proxy for wealth, which is a proxy for all sorts of advantages, computer camp in the summer, enrichment experiences being taken here and there by your parents, etc. The poorer the child, the more likely they are to lose ground over the summer break and start. So if you start the next year further behind while other kids have moved ahead and so on. I think the evidence is very clear that a good school is better for every child in it, and a bad school is worse for every child in it. But it's very rare that school itself can change the gaps between the tops and the bottoms, and not least because They have 10% of the child's life from birth to 18. And most of the conditions that make kids harder to teach and make it harder for them to learn are beyond the school's reach.
Some critics will claim that one-way policymakers effectively reduce that gap is by lowering the expectations on the higher achieving students.
So the closing the achievement gap is, you know, everyone always talks about it in the States, is we're going to bring the bottom up, but of course it's, I've thought for years, well, you could just depress the top and you know. But actually what you often see when schools make real progress, and several of the principals here at the conference were talking about this, is that, as we say, a rising tide lifts all the boats, but some of them were sort of hired to be, and they stay that way. And, you know, it's actually not true. We can say all children can learn. Well, that's true, but not all children can learn at the same rate, in the same way, in the same size class. And, you know, every school in America, if you look at their mission statements, they're training leaders. We don't train any followers in America. But most of us are followers, not leaders, you know. And I think we've had a lot of, I don't know what, aspirational talk about education. I think the evidence is pretty clear. I think there's 33 countries now where the achievement gap has been studied. It's the same everywhere. It's lower socioeconomic groups. It's immigrant groups. It's, you know, groups where, in the U.S., for example, where the family structure is much more broken up and so on. And there isn't any country that has solved this. And I think what it tells you is that it's not likely to. So I want to repeat, that doesn't mean that you don't want absolute top-notch schools or they're unimportant. It means they're not going to close by themselves gaps they didn't create and that other factors are working to maintain, even as the school tries to do what it can.
I wasn't at your talk myself, but I was watching some of the response to it on Twitter, and one of the things that was retweeted was that you said that children's lives are at odds with the values that schools expect, and that was retweeted a number of times. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's what I said earlier. I think if you want your children to grow up, to learn to persevere, to work hard, to defer gratification while they trying to acquire skills, you know, to not cheat, to pay attention, to devote themselves, to learn to apply themselves and all that. There's very little in the rest of their lives that are helping them. We talked here because the principals here see the same thing they do in the States. So, for example, lots of them, if the principal will be out front in the morning shaking hands with the students as they come in, and the students will shake hands. They don't look at you anymore. And this one principal in the U.S. said to me, I finally started holding their hand until they looked at me. So she said they finally looked up, but the line is getting longer and longer. So she had to have a whole school assembly and a little lesson on looking at a person when you say hello to them. Well, only 20 minutes, but it came out of learning time. And 10 years ago, she didn't have to do that, right? And parents are, you know, most people my age remember vividly, if you got in trouble at school, you'd get in trouble at home. Was that true for you?
It was.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you there's no school left in America now where they can count on that. And it doesn't sound like that here either. It happens. But they're much more likely to hear, I know he couldn't have done that because he told me so. Or, you know, he doesn't like it when you say that to him. And, you know, stuff like this.
It's a breakdown in authority.
Authority, but also in a sense that a child benefits from having to learn some things on his or her own and get used to sort of life in certain ways, but also that there's certain things you just don't do. And there's much, much less of that. And so schools, they don't just want to teach that. They actually need that to function as a community. And it's not that there's none of it. There's just much less. And that the kids are living lives. You know, I think I saw this thing the other day saying in the U.S. now they're averaging about 7 hours a day on screens of one kind or another. The evidence is growing very clearly that reading on a screen is a shallower experience than holding the text in your hand. And that it makes you much more likely to skim and scan. So it actually is sort of disabling certain kinds of reading. Well, I mean, the school, you know, the school can't stop that from happening. And if you talk to English teachers and literature teachers, they'll tell you that the kids have a harder time now, even when they're perfectly bright, understanding characters' motivation. Why would he do this? How come she felt that way? What? And it's not because they're not intelligent, but they're having a very different kind of experience outside of school that has an impact on what the school is trying to teach them, both in skills and in sort of habits and to some extent values.
Another idea that caught the imagination of the tweeters was the reach realism balance.
Yeah.
What is that?
So to me, what that is we've had years now of school change advocates saying, and with some real evidence, that a key to success is high standards. High standards for all, and the teachers and schools that expect more get more. That's true, certainly true up to a point. But I'm one of those who thinks that the expectations now are way beyond. So in the U.S., for example, it's national policy that all children will become proficient in, you know, certain in maths and literature and reading and writing and so on. Well, you can only do that if you distort the meaning of proficient, actually. It's like the deal is we're going to give a high-stakes test and every child has to pass it. So any teacher knows you can either make a test that everyone can pass or you can make a really high-stakes test, in which case everyone's not going to pass it. But you can't do both. That's our policy. So, I mean, it's absurd to begin with. And what it ignores is, and we talked about it yesterday, that what they were reacting to is, so that there's more and more expected, but the readiness of students to be students, not intelligence, the readiness to come to school, to sit down, to learn, to pay attention, to stay with things, to is in decline. More kindergartners are able to read, but fewer are able to form a line. I said that, and you could see heads nodding all around the room. And that's been true in any place I've ever been. This gap, then, to me, the reach is the high striving. You don't want to give up on that. The realism is the appreciation of the actual real-life baseline where you are, given the school you have, the money you have, the students who come to your school, everything else. And you can't just settle for the bottom, give up, but you can't expect to heal the sick and raise the dead. So what I try to say is what we want to do is have the high standards, but measure progress up from the beginning baseline, not just up against the ideal. And that in between this, that's the place to be, looking up, but looking back, and not being so depressed because we didn't get everybody, you know, up to the ceiling, and that we fail to see that actually most of them have made some movement here, and that teachers are often good about doing that for students, not for themselves, and their principals do that for them. But nobody does it for the principal, but him or herself, to say, so I know you have these high strides, that's good, but given what you were up against, you started here, this is where you've gotten to, that's positive movement there. And it's not trying to settle for just any old progress at all, but it's trying to say you can't burn out because you didn't heal the sick and raise the dead.
Finally, Rob, you're heading to the airport in just over an hour's time. What would you like Irish principals or teachers, but principals specifically, to remember of what you said after you've left?
Well, you know, I have to say honestly, I spent the first day here at the conference listening, and it was very sobering because I heard many things that sound very similar to what principals in the U.S. and elsewhere would describe as challenges, but other things that were much tougher. And it seems like things have really, really been hard, that the money has been bad, the cuts have been deep, and that the stress levels are very high among them. So I found myself feeling like you sort of would toss out a whole lot of the normal professional improvement manual or whatever, and that part of what needed to happen was to say, just first of all, to acknowledge this, and secondly, to say, so you do what you can as much as you can, as hard as you can, but that's, you know, you can't control it all. You have to build on your strengths, and you have to be willing to take some credit for what you have done instead of dwelling on what you haven't, and you have to lighten up some. And we talked a little about that at the end also, because my view is that if you're going to be hopeful, which again doesn't mean you have to be optimistic, if you're going to be hopeful, you have to know what you really care about. You have to put your shoulder to that wheel the best you can, and you have to be willing to say, that's what I can do. So it's a mixture of saying, don't give up, keep trying hard, but don't burn out, and en route, try to find a way where you can be more of your best self. And to me, that's how you end up as the best model for your teachers and for your community, of somebody who, even in difficult circumstances, can sort of be a model of kind of growth and progress and improvement and movement upward.
Sound advice there for principals and prospective principals from Dr. Rob Evans, who was a keynote speaker at the 2015 Conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank Rob Evans for his time. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.